You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
It's a lot of hands-on work, my friend.
That's I can imagine.
Yeah, I had to take a lot of antibiotics, but it was worth it. If you guys are tuning in, that's a little banter. That's a little pre-show banter between myself and Professor, Assistant Professor Justin Guest, who is a professor of political science, assistant professor at George Mason University, a school I almost went to, but chose to go to what they call Harvard and the Potomac American University. I got B's and C's in high school, Justin. So there it is. Welcome, Justin. Welcome to the mother of all podcasts.
Thanks very much. It's good to be here.
Yeah. Well, it's thank you for your book. Your book could not be more relevant in today's age. And I for one, grew up, I lived in the Middle East and the Muslim world for 8 years of my life. And I thought what was really interesting about this book in particular, and the book is called Apart, Alienated and Engaged Muslims in the West. That was very interesting about this book was you essentially talk about how a lot of the Muslims that tend to be radicalized in Europe, in the United States, but especially in Europe, are the Muslims that are second generation and are acutely aware of what a liberal democracy is. But because they've not been included in that democracy, they somehow feel even more, they're more apt to be radicalized. Is that a fair assessment of what's sort of original about this piece?
Absolutely. The book argues for what I call an integration paradox. Normally, when we think of people who are well integrated into their societies, we associate them with having some sort of familiarity with the culture, familiarity with the system of government, familiarity with the social customs, etc. And that's very much true. But with that familiarity, we also become acutely aware of the deficiencies of the society. And what I argue in the book is that it is precisely the people who are most aware of democracy and what it's supposed to be are those who are more likely to be disappointed and dissatisfied. And that leads to extreme political behavior.
But, you know, Justin, we've seen...
And just extreme political behavior is a euphemism for
terrorism.
Well, not just terrorism. Yeah. Not just terrorism. You know, I'm very cautious because it's actually not just... In a lot of ways, another, you know, what I think is a contribution of the book is an argument that we shouldn't actually just be worried about terrorism. Terrorism captures a lot of the headlines because it creates fear. But what we really need to worry about as well is people who are withdrawing from our society, who are withdrawing from the democratic channels of participation, and that won't get headlines because that's not going to scare anyone.
Well, that's actually what I gleaned from the book was when you've got 20 million Muslims and growing in Europe and certainly in the United States, but especially in Europe. I mean, I've spent enough time in London and in Paris, for example, to see their whole neighborhoods where you see women wearing burqas and, you know, I mean, it's primarily Muslim villages and neighborhoods. If you have huge swaths of those populations withdrawing and because they don't feel like they are part of the liberal democracy that is whatever, you know, the European Union, That is, I think, a way bigger problem. You're right, than just the idea that, well, he's going to strap a bomb. That's an extreme and very rare element, actually, isn't it? But the bigger problem, really, the more insidious problem, is a group of people that just somehow are going to start clinging to a mythology. The idea of, you know, I think if you listen to the people from ISIS, they're talking about, well, it used to be amazing in the 1500s when Muhammad ruled the world. It was a utopia, et cetera, et cetera.
So. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. What we have to worry about really pervasively is the, you know, wide-scale, widespread withdrawal of a group of people that, as you say, is a substantial proportion of society. In Europe, believe it or not, Brian, it's actually now up to 44 million Muslims, most of whom are immigrant origin in Europe right now. And this is as of 2010. Pew is projecting that number will reach 58 million in about 15 years. So that is a substantial portion of European societies, and Muslims are a substantial minority in the United States and Canada as well. And to have a large amount of young people withdrawing from a democratic system that requires, that is dependent upon people communicating their beliefs peacefully, is a really big problem. So it's, yes, terrorism grabs those headlines, but to basically have a group of people who is systematically apart from the rest of their community is really a democratic problem.
And then also what that does to the mainstream political conversation, because so much of what we've seen in places like Holland is that, you know, in reaction to this growing Muslim population, you know, politics gets shifted to the right. You get much more of these far right parties, you know, who are able to prey on people's fears of outsiders and all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, some of the sort of far right have now started to write all of these books about, you know, how Europe will be Muslim and, you know, it's going to become an Islamic state and all of that stuff.
Absolutely. And unless you have a substantial amount of Muslim voices to mm-hmm. counteract that in the democratic public sphere, those kinds of lies and myths and fear-mongering is going to keep going. And just to get the numbers straight here, guys, even though we have this growing Muslim population in Europe, it is still fractional compared to the overall population of Europe. There is not a single country except Belgium that is more than 10% Muslim in its total population.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. More than 10%.
Justin,
and by the way, Belgium is 10.1%, I think.
Wow. Well, Justin, my biggest question, though, then, is every minority that has moved in and immigrated to a country, the Jews and the Italians and the Irish in this country, for example, they've all had their share of discrimination but had no problem at the end integrating into the society. Why Muslims? Why such a difficult thing? Is it? Do we blame 9/11? Do we blame Middle East policy? Why are Muslims having? Why are they becoming more radicalized, more marginalized, more apart, as you say in the book?
Well, in Europe, it's a little different from the United States. The United States Muslim population is disproportionately wealthy, disproportionately well educated, disproportionately suburban, meaning they're not ghettoized mm-hmm. in urban.
In the United States, you're saying?
In the United States.
Right.
In Europe, the population tends to be more working class, less educated, and that can create different dynamics. But to answer your question, you know, the issue of Islam in Europe was really taking hold in on the continent way before 9/11. In fact, there are a number of riots in the United Kingdom about 2 or 3 months before 9/11, the summer before 9/11. And they
that.
Were and this was viewed through some lenses as a sort of Muslims against Britain kind of framework, but actually, many people actually viewed it as a brown people, or Asians, as they call them in the United Kingdom, South Asians, against Britain. And there was also a sense of consciousness amongst Muslims in the United Kingdom in particular, as far back as 1989 with the Salman Rushdie affair, when he published the Satanic Verses, and you saw, you know, wide-scale book burning, and eventually he was knighted by the Queen of England, and that caused further issues. In any case, there has been a Muslim consciousness in Europe that goes further back beyond 9/11. The tough part here is that you're not just dealing with a group that is religiously different the way Jewish minorities were in Europe and the United States around the turn of the century and thereafter. And you're not just dealing with a group that is visibly different the way you could think of Latinos in the United States. But, of course, you have a group now who is both religiously and visibly different. And that causes more problems because it causes more fear. Latinos are predominantly Catholic. Many are quite religious and socially conservative, and they fit in well with America's historically Christian population. The Jews are predominantly white, which means that they blend in socially more easily. Muslims don't have those luxuries, and the fans of social tension are flamed by Europe's really antiquated, but nevertheless their history of Muslim-Christian tension.
Well, you know, in the book you talk about the Satanic Verses, and it wasn't until I read that I remembered just how much of a firestorm that created. I was going to American University in Washington, down the road from you, and
Harvard on the Potomac.
That's right, and I remember a number of friends of mine who were Saudi and Lebanese, And I was amazed because they were just regular dudes who were more into getting laid and going out and hanging out and to at the clubs, and they were just friends. And I remember my buddy who had never been around Arabs was like, "These guys, Arabs are a blast. They don't really drink much, but they love to have a fun time." I was like, "Yeah, dude." Like he literally, I remember my buddy Joey. He was like, "Dude, I love all the Arabs. We gotta hang with the Arabs more. They're always so much fun, man. They just love to party, but they never get drunk, and they don't." But I was amazed when that book came out. How many of them were just outraged. I mean, they were outraged. They weren't calling for violence, but they were so angry about it. And I've never read the book. In fact, I remember trying to get it at a bookstore.
But that's the thing. The best thing that Salman Rushdie ever happened to his career was that fatwa.
Yes.
Because, yes. Like, you know, who has actually read a Salman Rushdie book?
But yes.
You know?
I've actually asked several preachers to issue a fatwa against me so they would help my sales.
I mean, that would be amazing. And listen, yeah. I mean, you know, he only had to go into hiding for like a decade. I mean, that's totally worth it.
Yeah. But it did highlight the fundamental difference between, you know, the West and, in this case, parts at least of the Middle East, or certainly the Christian world as it stands, as it stood back then, and the Muslim world in terms, and what I mean by that is when you issue a fatwa, when you say you are sentenced to death
for writing
a point of view, for your ideas and your point of view. I mean, that was so anathema to everything we stand for as a liberal democracy. And I'm speaking of Western Europe and the United States. And, you know, frankly, I was pretty outraged at, I thought to myself, if Iran thinks they can, how in the world does Iran want to join the world community with that kind of behavior? And what really bothered me was there wasn't, and you hear this a lot, there wasn't enough of the Muslim world coming out and saying, wait a minute, this is ridiculous, this is wrong, he should be allowed to say what he wants, when and how, right?
Right. I mean, I think that there are two things worth discussing about in light of the Rushdie affair that really inform what's going on today. And the first is kind of misunderstandings about how Islam works. So with regard to fatwas are merely forms of religious guidance. They're advisories that are put out by independent and individualized preachers or spiritual guides, imams, authorities. But in Islam, what's the most wonderful but also the most problematic part of the faith is that it is so wonderfully egalitarian, meaning, you know, one man's, you know, sheikh can be another person's sham. We have no idea. There's no one has the authority to basically disqualify the advice of someone. So the fatwa that was issued, while it did come from a reasonably authoritative preacher in Iran, it very easily could have been disputed by a number, or perhaps even the vast majority, of other Islamic spiritual guides and authorities around the world. And of course, their voice would have probably fallen quite mute compared to the hullabaloo over the initial fatwa. But because of that egalitarianism, no one can really say that what the initial fatwa was about is wrong. But fatwas are not just necessarily death sentences. A fatwa can be a religious advisory about, hey, it'd be religiously wise of you to go gluten-free. You know, it doesn't have to necessarily, you know, be a death sentence. It can advise on how to live a spiritual life. The second thing that comes out of the Rushdie affair is precisely what you guys are talking about. It is this realization of a sort of Muslim consciousness that came out of that. And I think this reveals the very postmodern ideas about how identity works. Everyone likes to think that I am one person and I remain that one person no matter what the context is. But that's just not true. What we see here is that we are one person, but that person is made up, is many layered and multifold, and there are many aspects and facets of that, our identity. And sometimes one can be emphasized when we feel like it is being threatened. And that's exactly what happened. A lot of people who were Muslim but didn't realize it all of a sudden felt threatened or vilified, and they said, well, hang on, I'm a Muslim too, and I don't like what you're saying.
Yeah, and Americans do that all the time. Like, yeah. I'm an American. What, you know, if you want to fan the flames of nationalism, we're very nationalistic. Side. I mean, the minute there's a terrorist attack, people get real American real fast. I mean, that's human.
Yeah, but there are cultural assumptions, and I think that's the thing is that, you know, there are lots of people who say very unpleasant things about the United States around the world, right? I mean, and many of them live in Iran. Now, that doesn't justify violence. Like, I think there is a fundamental disconnect there. I mean, you talked about, for example, the Jews. Yes, the Jews are religiously different, but that fundamental culture of dissent is something that is both Jewish and Christian. And if anything, I mean, there's much more of that dissent in Judaism, which is, you know, I mean, the recent book, you know, Startup Nation says that that culture of dissent is a large part of why Israel is so innovative. So, I mean, there are cultural differences in terms of how we go about finding truth. And, you know, in the United States, as you say in the book, we now have fundamentalists who believe that truth is found purely by revelation and the, you know, investigation, empiricism, science, all of these things don't work. And that is a real threat. That is a real threat to the intellectual life of the country when you don't believe that investigation, asking questions, getting things wrong, stating opinions and saying, oh, you know what, I was ignorant, I didn't realize that that was right. Like, when those mechanisms are not available to us as a culture, we have a real problem. And there is a difference in, you know, a lot of Islam, not all Islam, between how they go about finding truth and how we believe in doing it in the United States.
But, you know, I would be very careful before sort of essentializing, because, you know, if one thing to take away from this book is the diverse and sort of nuanced nature of the Muslim populations of Western countries like the United States and the United Kingdom and Spain, because part of the integration that I'm touting in the book is very much extends to these sort of cultures of dissent. I mean, Muslims in the United Kingdom, there are some communities that are remarkably politically active. I mean, almost extraordinarily so. And they do so in a very democratic, associational way that involves dissent, that involves peaceful protest, that involves running for office and supporting party campaigns. And you know, whether or not they are defying their inner culture, I think is something for, you know, Sam Huntington to talk about. That's not, I don't like discussing these kinds of things because I really don't know what the basis for them are. But I do think we can acknowledge that they are really well politically integrated into the political ethos of Western industrialized democracies.
Well, and I think that's the thing is, it's not, that's the thing. I don't think it's necessarily an essential thing about Islam, which is a lot of the claim that the right, for example, tries to make. You know, you can find strains of, you know, fundamentalism and revelation in any religion, and you can also find strains of investigation. I mean, if you want to talk about the real success of the caliphate, it was a culture of dissent. That's why they invented algebra and chemistry and all of these other things.
It was also wonderfully tolerant of minorities.
I mean, the people of the book.
Absolutely. I mean, you know. As long as you are a monotheist, at least, you know, if you were a Christian or you were a Jew, you were usually granted protection in the Muslim world, the Ottoman Empire and stuff. But I don't know what your status was. You were probably a bit of a second-class citizen. But you're right. One of the things I appreciated about the book was how I guess you used the word heterogeneous. There were just so many different points of view in the Muslim world, which makes total sense. But I hear this a lot, and I'd love you to speak on this. And I've read the Quran. One of the things you hear people say is that if you're Muslim, it is not synonymous with democracy. I have my own argument against this, but I want to hear what you have to say. Because the Quran is a blueprint for how to do everything in your life. So the separation of church and state is really kind of anathema to Islam because it's a blueprint. It teaches you how to bank. It teaches you how to be married. It teaches you how to clean your clothes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What do you say to that?
So I say very little, mostly because this is where I kind of keep my hat on as a political scientist and not a theologian. Mm. And I sort of leave this for theologians and comparative religion scholars. But what I will tell you is that empirically, what we see in the field is that maybe that's true in theory or in principle. Mm. And I'm not certain that necessarily is, because there is a history of consensus building consideration of different opinions in Islamic cultures. But what we see in the field is that there's certainly nothing that stops Muslims from being very healthily democratic. Mm. Of those 50, or I guess it's 45 million people who are of Muslim of the Muslim faith in Europe, the overwhelming majority of them are very politically active in peaceful ways in their democracies. And so there's certainly nothing that's hindering them from doing this. We see that there are Muslim members of parliament and members of Congress in the United States. We have two now. So there's really nothing out there that's stopping people from becoming very healthy Democrats in ways, like I said, that frequently is disproportionate to the rest of the population. Muslim communities have been very politically active, if for no other reason than their public vilification.
I think I agree with you 100%. That's one of the things I always say is that whenever I hear people say that stuff, I always say, look, you'd be amazed, and I really believe this probably because I lived there, you'd be amazed at how much, I talked to the average American, how much in common you have with the average Muslim in Egypt, in Iran, in Iraq, and in Syria, because for the most part, they probably aren't as religious as you think they are. They probably have their own doubts. They're trying to get through their day. They want a better life for their kids. And one of the things that I think is universal is everybody, no matter where you go, wants some say in who governs them, wants and believes they should be able to speak their mind, and so on and so forth. So I think that's what I always say. I think that, we would all be surprised at how much we have in common with so many people who we talk about as over there, especially in the Middle East. Don't you think?
Yeah, I do. I do think that that's true. And I think that one of the wonderful realizations that have come out of the Arab Spring, Arab Awakening, Arab whatever you want to call it right now, is the demonstration of an interest in democratizing in a lot of countries that we thought were destined to be ruled by sultans and autocrats, is that there is that desire there. What's so funny to me is how it is precisely the democratic governments in the West that are frequently resistant to democratization in the Arab world for fear of who they may elect.
Well, I mean, my God, look at our support of Saudi Arabia. Do you think Saudi Arabia is in any way remotely a democracy? No, they're just on our side.
They're autocrats, but they're our autocrats.
They are our autocrats. That's where the hypocrisy lives, and that's what I've always. That's something that we have to contend with. And so, and you provide solutions in this book. Can you talk a little bit about, how does Europe deal with this situation? Obviously, you've got to figure out a way to create an inclusive atmosphere. How do you do it?
Well, Europe's already failing just in that first step that you're talking about, creating an inclusive atmosphere. They are, villainizing a lot of their immigrant populations. They're trying to shut their gates to non-EU entry. They have silly controversies about banning minarets in Switzerland and headscarves in France. These are not helpful types of laws, and they're often baseless. The idea behind headscarf bans were not only that they weren't palatable to the French, but also that they could be a security risk because someone could rob a 7-Eleven and wear a headscarf or a niqab, a veil, and then you wouldn't know who their identity is. I don't know how many times 7-Elevens have been robbed by niqabis. It's just I just don't know. And in terms of how many minarets there are in Switzerland, I think there is some report that there are, I believe, two minarets that are currently in violation of the minaret ban. So, it's really exaggerating, social and religious differences between a community that's actually quite well integrated. So it really is about thinking as government and societies, what really matters and whether the measures that we are taking to prevent these headline extremists are actually hurting the relationship that we have with a lot of people who are actually otherwise quite happy to be in our countries and are quite active and integrated into our countries.
And who would be happier to be in our country if they weren't marginalized?
Absolutely right. Exactly. And that the danger of their marginality, the danger of their marginalization in some ways can be much greater than the isolated terrorist attack. And certainly this is not about undervaluing life. Every life is important. But your democracy becomes undermined when that takes place. So in terms of solutions, more proactive solutions rather than the don't create divisions with headscarf bans and minaret bans, more proactively, if I'm right, and the expectations of democracy matter, and the low level of people's perceptions of how strong their democracies are and the power that they're receiving from democracies are, then what we really need to address are very high inflated expectations of what democracy will provide, but also very low perceptions of what democracies do provide. And I think we can do that by actually doing more civic education and actually engaging Muslim communities to demonstrate not only how much government and societies are doing for Muslim populations, but also the limits of what democracy can do. Democracy doesn't mean that you're going to get your way every single time. Democracy doesn't mean that you're going to win every debate. But it does mean that you have the chance to express your views.
Boy, when I hear you talk that way, though, I think to myself, it ain't going to happen. I always think to myself, I feel as though the real question is, what responsibility do Muslim immigrants have to create that situation for themselves?
And this is a great question, Brian. This is a really great question, because Muslim mosques and Muslim community centers are currently in a fight for the brains, for the minds of young Muslims in their countries. These are often second and third generation young Muslims who feel very Muslim because people point at them and say, you're a Muslim, you're different. So they are very much aware of the difference, but they often don't understand why they're different. And rather than addressing why they're different and addressing tough, controversial political issues and social issues in mosques and Muslim community centers and on listservs and emails and social media, many Muslim community centers and Muslim leaders are bypassing these debates. They don't want to have them because they're so divisive and polarizing. But actually, that is the exact opposite of what they should do. They should be engaging young people and bringing them into the fold, because the problem is, if they don't address these debates, other people will, and these other people are frequently much less savory.
And I think the other thing that's important to recognize, though, is that by definition of the fact that you're saying that there is a process of education that needs to happen, there is a recognition that Muslims arriving from places like Morocco and Iraq and all of these sorts of things are not ready for democracy. You know, and I think that's a very, very interesting point, because, you know, we have this very naive understanding of democracy that, you know, simply by being a person, you're ready to take place in democracy. But they don't realize that by living in a democracy and growing up in a democracy, you are internalizing values that make democracy possible. The example that Lawrence Lessig gives in Republic Lost is, you know, in the United States, you can walk into, you know, a store, hand over a piece of plastic and walk out with a car for temporary use on the understanding that you will return it, right? That level of trust, that sort of stuff that is developed from growing up in a working system, is not something that immigrants often have. And so, you know, I mean, for example, there's a huge difference between how Armenians who grew up in the Soviet Union and Armenians who grew up in Lebanon drive, right? Because of the level of trust that they have in the system, right? You know, Lebanon was a country that worked relatively well, and the Soviet Union was a coercive system.
Yeah, you know, I actually think that this is sort of apples and oranges, though, Hunter, because what we're talking about with people who are just arriving off the boat or jet is the first generation of immigrants. And I think the issues with political behavior right now and people being withdrawn or potentially politically violent is mostly taking place amongst the second and third generation. This is not taking place amongst people who don't understand how democracies work. Most of these young people, and every young person that I interviewed for this book, was a second generation British-born, Spanish-born, or at least came over in their childhood Muslim. They were as American as apple, or I should say, as British as a meat pie. You know, they knew how democracy worked. So it's not a lack of acquaintance with the democratic system that's the problem for the young people that I was interviewing. I mean, you're absolutely right that there is an education process there, and I think that the credit card example is actually a brilliant analogy there. But for the people that we're talking about here in terms of the alienated and the marginalized, they understand democracies quite well. That's actually part of the problem, is that they're quite disappointed with them.
Well, they understand how – I mean, you know, when I read your book, a lot of what it actually reminded me of is, you know, Pinker in The Better Angels of Our Nature. He talks about the degree to which, you know, even though African Americans live under the laws of the United States, they are essentially alienated from it because those laws don't really apply to them. Like, the treatment that they get is different from the laws of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this problem of disengagement and, you know, people not, you know, being legally within the system, but essentially culturally and in practice, right, Jim Crow law style, not actually part of the system, is a huge, huge problem.
Absolutely. And while we're sort of putting books on the syllabus for this, I would strongly recommend Cass Sunstein's Laws of Fear. Mm-hmm. The final chapter of that book discusses the way that laws are frequently legislated, they're made, but also implemented in different ways for different people. Mm-hmm. So when we create a law that says that you can be lawfully detained without charges being held against you, many Americans will say, yeah, well, let's do that because we want to prevent terrorism. But they're agreeing to this knowing full well that they're highly unlikely to be subject to those laws. Mm.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that Hunter said, we should ask the question, did Osama bin Laden actually win the war on terrorism? You could actually ask that question. There's serious debate about that in some ways. I mean, it has created a more repressive society. Certainly, I don't think, after having read Fiasco, I think it's Thomas Rick's book on sort of the beginning of the Iraq War, we were put in a position for a lot of reasons and a lot of people behaved in ways that were fairly un-American or certainly didn't hold up to the standards of what we consider to be the things that Americans are held to.
Nobody does overcompensation like the United States of America.
Damn right. What is your nationality, Justin? What got you to write this book about Muslims? Are you Muslim yourself? Did you have experience with this? Are you just a political scientist who was looking at this issue?
I am an Angeleno, born and raised in Mar Vista near Venice Beach. And I know social division very well because I went to an L.A. Unified School District high school and middle school.
Which one did you go to?
I'm a product of University High School, Emerson Middle School, and Warner Avenue Elementary in Los Angeles,
damn,
where you guys are right now.
Because I lived in Venice for 18 years. I was right across the street from Venice High School. So keep going. I love it.
I hope you kept the bars up on the windows. So, which some buildings still have down there.
Yes.
They're like $2 million houses with bars on their first floor windows.
That's exactly right, yeah.
So, you know, I grew up in a very diverse environment at schools where white people like me were the minority. Mm. And I moved to London to do my PhD. And while I was there, I was very interested in studying global affairs and immigration. And I was struck by the nature of the social division in the aftermath of Britain's 9/11, which were the 7/7 bombings on July 7th of 2005,
yep,
when the London transport system was attacked. And I arrived about 2 months after that took place, and the atmosphere was absolutely ripe with tension. And so for someone interested in studying immigration and global affairs, this was a really fruitful opportunity, I think, to study something in a real live laboratory that is London, and eventually I also studied Madrid for the purposes of this book and my dissertation. So, you know, I was already very much interested in these subject matters, and this was just simply a convenient, opportunistic move to study this particular issue.
Well, and I think the you know, one of the facts that I, you know, really grabbed me at the beginning of the book is in the United Kingdom, a 2006 survey reported that one-third of 18 to 24-year-old Muslims would rather live under the provisions of Sharia law than under British law. And I think those are the sort of statistics that, you know, terrify a lot of people about what happens if Muslims do participate in democracy. Like, what happens if they decide to enact Sharia law, which is, you know, I mean,
Or Sharia law.
Oh, I'm sorry, Brian. Do you want to maybe say it in a slightly more Arab accent? Sharia.
Sorry. Asif.
Anasif.
Halas. Enough. Halas. We get the point.
Yeah.
We get the point.
Yeah, Habibi, keep going.
Habibi. But anyway, I think that's the thing is, you know, that sort of statistic would be used by, say, the far right to say, oh, this is evidence that, you know, our values are under threat.
And it scares me. It scares me too, by the way. It scares me too.
Well, I think we should ask the members of the far right, who are predominantly Christian, how many of them would rather the New Testament provide the basis for society in the United States. And I think you might find similar numbers.
Damn good question, brother. Damn good question. That is so spot on, man. There is something called a Christian fundamentalist, and you can find them all over this country. and they are pretty extreme in their beliefs. So that, amen to that.
Well, but I think the interesting thing, right, is that it all comes down to interpretation. Like people, fundamentalists always cherry pick exactly which parts of the Holy Scriptures they choose to, you know. Because, I mean, the New Testament, if you want to talk about living under the laws of the New Testament, it's pretty simple, right? Love thy neighbor as thyself and honor the Lord your God, right? And that's it. So, I mean, you know, but there are a lot of things that Christian fundamentalists would advocate for that don't necessarily fall under loving thy neighbor as thyself.
And in the same controversies over interpretation plague Islam in the same way that they plague Christianity in our societies, in the same way they plague Judeo-Christian understandings and principles.
Well, I've always said
people understand it in different ways.
Yeah, but if you were a Jew, if somebody said, what's this Jewish religion about? And I gave you the book of Deuteronomy, if you read just Deuteronomy, you'd have a very different point of view about who these Jews are. You'd be like, wait a minute, these Israelites go off and kill everybody. This is crazy. You know, so you're right. I mean, you have to be careful what you read, in what context you read it, the religion has come from, you know.
They did kill Jesus, Brian. Never forget that.
Wait a minute, that was the Romans, you bastard.
Yeah. And, you know, in any case, Islam even makes space for these kinds of debates and controversies. I mean, one of the most polemical words you can speak with regard to Islamic interpretation is the word ijtihad, which literally means to interpret. And it, by the way, it comes from the same root as jihad, which, of course, is its own four-letter word in American society and worldwide now. But it means to interpret and get the true understanding of Islam. And people disagree. And these disagreements are plaguing Muslim relations within Muslim societies right now. So, you know, the same kinds of debates that the Judeo-Christian world has inside of their societies about what is actually morally right and what is even the Christian way of life are very much present in Muslim societies as well.
But are they? I mean, I think that's the thing. Since you've brought up the word ijtihad, right, which, I mean, since we're talking about Arabic, that's actually a form 7 of that root, jihad, which actually means it's a reflexive form. So it's actually struggle with yourself.
So smart.
Oh, my God.
Hunter,
oh, my
you're
God.
Such a linguist. Keep going.
But, you know, I mean, one of the things that we also hear talked about a lot with Islam is the closing of the gates of ijtihad, right, that essentially that Muslim history reached this point where it decided that all that could be known about the Quran was already known, and that then it was just about really memorizing the findings that had already been made. And the degree to which how much self-evaluation and how much struggle is really going on. I mean, you know, yes, there's lots of argument about interpretation, but the question is, what is the quality of that interpretation? I mean, when my parents were in Libya, for example, there was a guy that, you know, they were talking to, and he kept on talking about Guantanamo Bay. And, you know, at a certain point, like, the person they were talking to was like, don't you mean Guantanamo Bay? And they go, no. The letter G did not exist in the time of the prophet, so we can't call it Guantanamo Bay. We have to call it Guantanamo. But see, I mean, you know, or the kite runner, right, where you can't, like, fly kites because there were no kites in the Quran, or toothpaste or anything like that. Yes, there's debate and there's struggle going on. But there's a difference between asking those sorts of questions and asking questions about, is it ever acceptable to threaten someone with death because they wrote a book that you disagree with?
Right. But I mean, one thing to keep in mind here, you know, when people close gates, it's usually because they're already inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're closing the gates of ijtihad, it's probably because you're satisfied by the status quo. And that's, of course, convenient to those who are advantaged and favored by the status quo. But let me tell you right now, Islam is alive and well with plenty of dissent and interpretation and people struggling to understand its true meaning and its application. And that's never going to end because there's always going to be people with alternative ideas. And if it really was closed, then, you know, Al Jazeera would have a lot less programming in the Middle East right now.
Yeah, and that's it's also human. Yemen had a really cool pilot program. They take these radicalized youth who had been caught doing these crimes and things, and they'd sit them in front of a bunch of Islamic clerics who would basically say, okay, what's your interpretation of Islam? And we will argue we will see if we can argue your point of view out of yourself. You know, we'll argue you out of it. And it had really big, really great results. I mean, it was sort of they said, here are your ideas and let us put them to the test. We're Islamic clerics and we're going to basically debunk those ideas. It was a really successful.
But in the 21st century, I totally agree. And, you know, what's smart about that is that you're engaging with them on the terms that they already respect. They respect these clerics. And so, you know, they're people who are effective change agents. But at the same time, have we not reached a stage in the 21st century where we should be establishing certain norms? And one of those norms is that, you know, societies that allow for dissent and that don't resort to violence to settle arguments are better. And I'm not saying like the vast majority of Muslims are awesome, right? But, you know, do we not like, and by the same token with fundamentalism, right, Christian fundamentalism, should we really be saying that, you know, revelation is an appropriate way to come up with answers? Or should there be...
Probably not. I think, Justin, you would probably say that the vast majority of Muslims agree that violence is not the answer.
No, that's absolutely right.
Right.
But shouldn't we all be clear on that? That should be a value that we're all establishing. Like, the commitment to
I think it is, and I think that there are people that are not going to feel that way, like the people who run ISIL and all that. But for the most part, I don't know that that is so much the question. I think the bigger question, Justin, is do you think that the Muslim leadership is guilty of not being more vocal and more clear about having a moderate message? Is there more work to be done for them?
You know, it's so tough to say because there are so many moderate Muslims who speak clearly and really quite reasonably in ways that I think would be harmonious to a lot of Americans' ears and Europeans' ears for that matter. They don't get very good publicity, and it's for good reason. What they're saying is boring. What they're saying is the kind of stuff that we're talking about right now that every American citizen knows, being peaceful, allowing for dissent, and eschewing violence. You know, that's never going to make the headlines of the New York Times or even the New York Post for that matter.
That's true.
And so it's very, very difficult to say, oh, well, no one ever hears them when they're saying anything. Well, that's because no one's really paying attention because they're not saying anything very interesting. You know, I once wrote an op-ed for The Guardian in the UK, and I think I co-authored it with a local imam from East London, Usama Hassan. And, you know, our title was Everybody Loves a Villain. And it was about a local preacher who had an eye patch and a hooked arm. He was not a pirate. He was a Muslim.
God.
And he looked evil, and he said horribly evil things. And, you know, and it was true. The television adored him. You know, newspapers loved him. He sold newspapers off of newsstands whenever he opened his mouth. And he was saying ridiculous things, had very few followers. Mm-hmm. But boy, did he have a microphone in front of him. And so it's just very easy to underestimate the amount of moderation that's being preached by many Muslim leaders. And, you know, is there the way to, you know, potentially do it, though, is to work at the mosque level, the mosque-based level, because that is the first line of defense against radicalization. Mm-hmm. Is the people who are there to speak about Islam should be talking about Islam, and they should be speaking about Islam in ways that young people care about, and they should be answering the questions that young people have. And they, you know, when
Justin,
young people ask the question.
But Justin, isn't there a tradition of? I mean, wasn't Muhammad himself a warrior? A general.
He was also a merchant.
A leader of armies. I mean, there is the idea that the myth of Saladin who solved problems with the sword.
But Saladin was also, or Saladin, since we're constantly correcting each other's
pronunciation. I say Saladin. Saladin.
Oh, okay.
Sahladin.
Habibi.
Sahladin.
Oh, my God. Just start adding in guttural sounds because then it sounds more Arabic.
Sahladin. But you know what I'm saying? Oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I mean, that's the whole point. Like, why did Saladin become a hero? He became a hero in response to the crusading invaders,
that's true.
Right?
And he unified, yeah.
Yeah. So.
But Justin, isn't there sort of, and I've heard this just, you know, doesn't the Quran have more violence? Wasn't Muhammad sort of the guy with the sword who solved some problems that way as opposed to turning the other cheek?
Well, it's also
again, you know, I resist the sort of temptations to go into theology, but I would ask that, you know, I think that the same kinds of heroes are lionized in the Old Testament and the New Testament.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, we have these heroes in Christianity and Judaism that do precisely the same thing, perhaps with less success. I don't know. As a Jew, I think we always lose. But, you know,
I love that you're a Jew and you wrote a book about Muslim. I love that. Thank
when
you.
When the book came out, my Jewish ninth grade and 10th grade algebra teacher, Mr. Solig, if he listens to your podcast, he said to me at the book launch at Barnes & Noble in West L.A., he said, "What's a nice Jewish boy like you writing about Muslims in Europe?"
God bless you. I love it. That's always the case, though. I always said about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Palestinians were so – the biggest mistake they made was picking up – was strapping bombs to themselves. You were dealing with the Jews. All you had to do is stage major sit-ins and just work on Jewish guilt. And you'd have – I'm telling you, they would have – every Palestinian would have a Jewish lawyer at their side going, "These people need their rights. The Knesset is wrong. Netanyahu and you know, Ariel Sharon never would have been in power. Never. Just play on the that's literally all they had to do. Just play on the spirit of democracy."
Well, spending a lot of time with Muslims in a lot of different places, including mosques, but certainly not limited to them, because I spent a lot of time playing ping pong and hanging out on corners with drug dealers. But spending a lot of time with the Muslim communities of Europe has really made me much more reflective about my own self-understanding as a Jew, you know, and I realize that a lot of the problems that we criticize Muslims for having are precisely the same kinds of existential problems that Jews have with their own faith for centuries. The only difference is that Muslims have these problems with a magnifying glass hovering over them at all times in Western societies.
Well, there are also a lot more of them. I mean, you know, if you're a Jew, you make up 0.01% of the population.
A lot of what we're talking about and a lot of what you were pointing at, you know, is this is all a problem of visibility, right? Like, I mean, you know, when my parents were in Libya, right, they said that there were 7,000 Salafis, 7,000 fundamentalists in a country of 7 million people, right? You know, the squeaky wheel always gets the grease. And I think that's, you know, what's a problem for American society and European society in general is to really make the moderate Muslims, the ones who have jobs, who just, you know, want a job, who, you know, have families. We need to make them more visible. But there's no sort of unifying movement that allows us to see, you know, the forest for the trees.
Right. Right. And, you know, there are certain double standards. You know, we are going to be prone to freaking out and overcompensating when there is a Muslim involved in a certain deviant activity than when someone else is involved. You know, I think about the various horrendous university shootings that we hear about, like at UC Santa Barbara and Virginia Tech. Imagine if these weren't just disgruntled, you know, sexually repressed 20-year-olds, but imagine that these were young Muslims who were trying to make a political statement. Would we treat it differently from the political or social statement being made by the young Americans who were doing these acts at these universities and college campuses? Do we treat Oklahoma City by McVeigh differently than we treat the Boston Marathon bombings? I think we do.
Of course we do, but I think that's the thing, is that, you know, that's because that's, I mean, it's not unreasonable for the American people to react that way. Like, that's what's come to the fore in their psychology. By the same token, if, you know, the Timothy McVeigh survivalists who were, you know, trying to take down the country from within, if they had more of a following and they were seen as the major existential threat to the United States, then we would overreact anytime, you know, some of the Timothy McVeigh crowd did anything. But it just so happens that, you know, currently the existential threat in the mind of most Americans is, you know, fundamentalist Islamic terrorism.
And, you know, I think if your listeners are still actually even listening, I think that if they're going to take anything away from our conversation today, is I'd like people to ask themselves just how existential this threat is.
It's not. I mean, we had a really great interview with Robert Kaplan, who writes for Stratfor, and he wrote an op-ed called "Terrorism is Theater." And, you know, I mean, George Friedman, who wrote The Next 100 Years, said a very, very similar thing. It may have been in the next 100 years or the next decade. But he was basically saying the nature of terrorism is such that they cannot actually destroy their enemy. Like, the Osama bin Laden never had the capacity to invade the United States and occupy the United States. Yeah. The only thing that he could do is freak us out enough that we did something stupid, like get involved in two wars that, you know, were massively expensive and that we had no exit strategy from.
And mobilize an enormous army of young cadets who want to support him in the process.
That's right.
On that topic, Justin, what if anything, do you think we should do about ISIS?
gosh, guys, this is such a difficult issue, and I really is beyond what I actually focus a lot of my time on, and so I think I'll probably punt. It's not the most entertaining answer.
No, I appreciate
that.
But
I think I need to know more before I really start spewing my ideas.
Spoken like a true academic.
Yeah. Sorry, guys.
I appreciate it.
But it's also academically honest. I mean, I think that's the thing. We need more people in this country who are willing to say,
I wish more politicians said that. Yeah, I love it.
But what you will say...
My father used to say that the sign of an intelligent person is someone who actually says, I don't know.
It's true.
So, and in this case, I think that's... I'm going to have to pretend like I'm intelligent. One thing I will point to, though, is the reaction of Norway in the aftermath of the Breivik incidents. I mean, that was, you know, one of the most horrible national tragedies you could possibly imagine. Mm. And their response could not have been more restrained, I think. And I think that as a result, they didn't fan the tensions that were already present in their country further. Instead, they lamented this and tried to ensure that it never happened again, rather than, you know, seeking retaliation. And again, I'll use that word, overcompensating.
Yeah, and the guy who did it was a Christian fundamentalist.
That's right.
But so I think that's what we're really saying is, you know, that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Like, the whole nature of terrorism is it relies on fear. And the more we buy into that culture of fear, the worse we make the problems.
I think that's right. I mean, this is, you know, thank goodness this is not Nazism. You know, this is not the march of Hitler across Europe right now.
Well, but we may get there.
Yeah.
Listen, never sell humanity short. Yeah. We can always reach that place.
Justin, your book is important, and I think that everybody should. This is something that is so timely right now. I appreciate the effort you put into this, and I think it says a lot about you. So, thank you, Justin Guest. Apart, Alienated and Engaged Muslims in the West. And what I really appreciate about this book is it gives us insights, and I'm speaking of the United States, and how to avoid the problems facing Europe. And I think they're very relevant, and I think you make a very good argument here.
But I also think it's a really great lens into a much larger human phenomenon of what happens when people become excluded from democracies.
That's right.
And what we need to do to make sure that they are included, because it's not sufficient to have a law in the books that says, you can vote.
Yeah.
You have to, if somebody's not voting, then we have to reach out and figure out what are we doing that's not allowing them to vote.
Human beings are tribal, and...
Yeah.
And I think that, if anything, oppression and marginalization just creates stronger, more resilient lines. Those lines go from being blurred to being very, very, very much stark and in the forefront. So.
But I would say that, I mean, you know, if anything comes out of this, and if there are listeners listening, you know,
20,
still at this
25,000
point. 25,000, yeah. But I mean, I think that's the thing. I think part of what we need to figure out as Americans, as Europeans, as people in general, is how to create more visibility for that Muslim majority. Like, how do we make it so that we are aware of, you know, the 99% of
If you
Muslim...
want to know how to do that, you start with a book called Apart by Justin Guest, Alien and Engaged Muslims
Brian,
in the
West. Is it available on Amazon.com?
You darn right it is. And I think we have a flag on our website.
Yeah, we will.
All the way from Venice Beach, California, Justin Guest.
A product of LAUSD.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you so much, Justin.
Dude, well done.
Thank you, guys.
Well
done.
Interest. Thank you very much, man. Stay in touch.
You got it.
All right. Justin Guest, ladies and gentlemen. I love it. Well, there it is. There it is. We solved that problem.
Did we?
We just keep solving problem after
problem.
Did
we solve it, Brian? Or did we just sort of like slightly figure it out a little bit
Well,
more?
You know, one of the things that I always try to avoid is like there's these things that we need to figure. You hear this a lot. Gun control, somebody goes and kills a bunch of people, the Muslims in Europe. And there tends to be this thing where we need to really figure out a way to include these people. And my thing is, no, we're never going to do that. It's probably the wrong play. One of the things you've taught me is that it's all a question of where you place your energy and your focus. And I think it's always up to, for the most part, like, for example, the young Muslims or the Muslim leadership or Muslims in general in Europe to figure out a way to solve this problem. And it is a problem. How do they make themselves more inclusive? And I don't know what example you follow, maybe an amalgam of all the different cultures that have done it before them, but this is something that needs to be done. Or you will continue to be marginalized. It's a little bit like the Middle East. You can go all the way back to the Mongols.
Yeah, but it's
talk
always
about the invasions and talk about why they aren't there aren't so many democracies in the Middle East out of those 22 countries or whatever. Listen, it doesn't matter anymore. What matters is solving that problem.
But I think that's the thing is, you know, like it's so much of it is that, I mean, since we're talking specifically about alienated Muslim youth, we're sitting here as the rest of the country and being like, you guys should fix this. This should be no longer a problem. And I think part of what Justin is really driving at in the book is that it's a two-way street.
Yeah.
Like we have to figure out what it is we're doing that's not including these people, because fundamentally, this is not a problem for just them. This is a problem for all of us. You know,
think though a lot of it's commerce. Man, when you have a house, plenty to eat, and status, and a car, you know, those other things, that thing about I'm a Muslim, they kind of go away. When the country you're living in works, you become a little more British. You become a little more American.
Yeah, but that's the thing is the country working for them. Right.
Okay. Then my thing is, listen, what do you got to do? This country has got liberal institutions and democracy and an economy. Figure out how you're going to fit in. I got to do that every day as a comic. Now, granted, I'm the greatest comic of all time.
You don't have to fit in, Brian, because people, you know, just like flock to you. Like you have to understand
called,
the experience that you have.
That's called Jesus energy.
Yeah, but your Jesus energy.
There's our light. It's been an hour.
Brian, you just wanted to end on Jesus energy.
Of course I did.
But you have to understand, Brian, your experience of life is not representative. You have to try and remember what it's like before you were
human?
Famous.
To
yeah,
be human?
Yeah, to be human. Damn to be it. Not a god.
I know. I hate when people call me a god, but it is kind of true, especially when I take my shirt off. People go, how is that real, dude?
And then they realize, oh, no, it doesn't work by natural laws. It works by supernatural forces.
Well, I also do a lot of deadlift, and I never eat gluten.
But,
gluten,
Brian, gluten. Is it hard for you to deadlift things? Because aren't you mostly doing it with your mind and then just sort of moving your hands to not draw attention?
Damn it, Hunter. All my secrets revealed in one podcast. Shucks.
Yeah, well.
I also tie my dong to it. All right. You see what happens? Talking about important things, and now I'm talking about my dong.
Which is an important thing. I mean, is
well,
that
I like,
not important
I like referring
to
it as my dong because it sounds like it's so big it has an echo. My it dong. Also,
oh, well, I was going to say it makes it sound like some sort of British female aristocracy. My dong.
Oh.
You're welcome, my dong.
It sounds vaguely Asian. Something
it could be.
Mandarin.
Or Vietnamese.
Oh, that's actually way more
yeah,
Vietnamese.
Yeah, Vietnamese, yeah.
It's like a river in China.
Yeah.
A dong.
That is a very good, very good
one of the interesting
impression of a Vietnamese pirate.
Yeah, just in case people think I'm being racist, I just want to clarify that, you know, that's one of the rare tones that exists in Vietnamese, which is which you don't find in most languages.
I will say this. I've seen some painfully beautiful Vietnamese women. Out there. So thank you for your wonderful sort of off brown golden skin and good attitude. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I got to get out of here. I'm a married man and I'm just not speaking from experience. I just have seen that in bars. I got to go. Thank you. And go to briancallen.com if you want to come see me do comedy, but only if you don't mind laughing too hard, simply too hard.
Wait a minute, Brian, where should they go if they want to see Madong?
Madong? Oh, it's all over the internet.
Where is that?
Spooky ghost has exposed that. So many people want to see the 47-year-old comic. Sorry, I start to retch.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.